You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Teresa Sue Hilt, also known as Tess. You can also find today's episode in video format on my YouTube channel, which I will have linked in the show notes below. It's Aaron with the Sipping on Some Crime podcast, and I'm here today to tell you about Teresa Sue Hilt, affectionately known as Tess. 22-year-old Tess was a university student working towards her master's degree in Missouri Northwest State University when in 1973 she would be brutally murdered in her campus apartment. Tess was a bright light to everyone, and I know people often say that, but when Tess walked into a room, she really did light it up. It was because she was so social and genuine, and she was truly adored by so many people in different social groups all across campus. Tess had this energy about her that just seemed to have people gravitate towards her. Tess was super involved in the university. She worked on the yearbook. She worked with sorority sisters in a little sister program. She was also in the theater, and she found herself on student council as well. At just 5 feet tall, this blonde with an infectious smile could often be found with friends socializing. Tess had already earned her bachelor's degree in music education, but was working towards her master's degree in counseling. Tess was very goal-driven, had lots of friends, and was very loved by her family. Tess had big dreams and a full life ahead of her. Tess lived on campus in apartments, and we know she was close to many of the friends that lived in her apartment complex. They all spoke so kindly of Tess and said she had such a beautiful spirit. Because Tess was so well known on campus, investigators do have a lot of details leading up to her death. Here's the events we know based on witnesses and extensive police interviews. Tess would attend a party Friday night between 10 and 11 p.m. After the party, Tess would decide to visit Edward, her friend, who was 19, who lived in the same apartment complex as Tess. Tess and Edward would hang out at his apartment till about 2 a.m. when two of Edward's friends came over. At that point, Tess decided that she was going to head home. The distance between Tess and Edward's apartments were about 60 feet, but they were two different complexes, so Tess would have to exit out of Edward's apartment through the main complex door and walk about 60 feet to the main entrance of her apartment complex building. For my visual listeners, the apartment complex was kind of in an open square. There was two apartments across from each other and one that ran long ways across the backside, creating almost a U shape. And in between that was an open courtyard. As always, I will be posting those pictures on my website for those interested. This large open courtyard is where investigators believe that Tess might have met her killer. Before Tess left Edward's apartment, they had made plans to get together and hang out on August 4th, 1973. The following day, on the 4th, Edward, who had been calling Tess's apartment and getting no answer, decided to walk over to her apartment and see what was going on. Edward would knock on Tess's door and get no answer, and so he would decide to walk into her unlocked apartment. Now, I know this sounds strange, but this is how Tess was. She left her apartment unlocked, and she didn't mind her friends coming and going. When Edward walked into Tess's apartment, he didn't see her, but as he walked back to her bedroom, he would find her lying on her bed, naked and lifeless, with a sheet folded neatly over her body. When investigators arrived, there would be no sign of forced entry, but like I said before, Tess was known to leave her apartment unlocked. And again, she didn't mind friends coming and going. Tess's murder was very brutal, and as usual, I won't be going over too many details, but of course, they are out there if you want to know. Tess had suffered many stab wounds and a broken neck. And the reason I bring up those specific incidents is because it brings back to theories that investigators have. The many stab wounds and the broken neck are important to mention because it leads to investigators' initial theory. Based on the stab wounds wounds and the brutality, investigators believe that this was a very rage-filled personal attack. Based on the wounds that Tess had endured, there must have been a scuffle, there must have been noise, and the scene was too clean for the brutality of this murder. No one in the apartment complex reported hearing anything, and it seemed as if the apartment was meticulously cleaned and staged. Investigators noted right away that these apartment walls were very thin. As they were standing in Tess's apartment, taking in the scene, they could hear many apartments around them speaking and moving around. This is what led investigators to believe that Tess definitely knew her killer. The lead sergeant on the case told the St. Joseph News, quote, "Everything was so neat. The place had been cleaned after what must have been quite a struggle. Blood was generally wiped away. It was even wiped partially from the paring knife, which was apparently used in the murder. But there were still spots of blood in such places as the light switch and on part of the wall. It was just too neat of a job to be done by a man," unquote. The autopsy also showed no sexual assault or violence during the altercation, and in fact showed that Tess never had any sexual encounters, period. Investigators also noted that the sheet being pulled over Tess and folded so neatly wasn't something they believed would be done by a man. State Highway Patrol Sergeant Rode, who was involved from the very beginning, would say, quote, "I have seen a number of murders, but this was the most brutal. Whoever committed this crime needs help," unquote. We knew in the 70s we didn't know much about DNA, and we definitely didn't know much about the advancements in the forensic science that we would have today. But investigators did their best collecting what they thought might be useful in the future. Investigators would gather what they believed would be key evidence in Tess's case: a paring knife, a paper napkin, numerous papers found scattered around the apartment, and a paper with a list of names and phone numbers. And right away, they began contacting everyone on that list. The evidence that they collected would be first sent to the State Highway Laboratory at Jefferson City, and then sent to the FBI Investigation Laboratory in DC. Investigators started, of course, with Edward, since he was the last person to see Tess alive, and they heavily questioned him over and over again, and he was very cooperative and even passed a polygraph test. Investigators believe that the courtyard is where Tess met her fellow play, who either persuaded her to go with them or grabbed her and made her go by force. The reason investigators believe that Tess was initially taken away from the apartment complex before being brought back to her apartment was because they would find her traveler checks in the apartment parking lot adjacent to hers, and then her wallet would be found near railroad tracks south of the apartment complex. Investigators believe that the killer or killers brought Tess back to her apartment alive and then killed her in her own home. Sergeant Wright from the Maryvale's PD would be assigned to Tess's case from the beginning, and at 6 months in to the investigation, he would tell St. Joseph's News that he was sure of three things. One, the killer was a woman. Two, that the murder took place in Tess's basement apartment. And three, that Tess did not go straight to her home after Edward's apartment. Many articles go on to point to what I was saying earlier, that Tess was a very popular girl on campus and she left her apartment door unlocked. In fact, she left a notepad on the outside of her apartment so that friends could leave her messages as she was coming and going. And it wouldn't be weird for her to come home and find a friend in her apartment. With Tess being so well known from the yearbook, from student council, and she had just played Peppermint Patty in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, there were many different groups of people that investigators had to catch up with and interview. Tess was also said to be a very kind-hearted person, so if she ran into somebody that she didn't know that was struggling, she would offer them food, she would offer them money, she would offer them a place to stay. Tess was also known to attend many campus parties, but she wasn't a big drinker. Her friends say that she would typically get one drink and nurse it all night long. She wasn't the wild party child type, she was just the social butterfly type and wanted to be where people were. Some of the evidence that investigators found in Tess's apartment was a lot of tapes of her talking or singing. These were recordings she made herself. She was a music major and she loved to act, so these tapes made complete sense to investigators. They would collect all the tapes in the apartment and spend hours poring over these tapes looking for clues. There were a few things that hindered Tess's investigation from the very beginning. One of them being that there wasn't a sergeant assigned to Tess's case until 2 months into the investigation, which meant there were many hands in the pot without any direction. There was also a delay in the initial autopsy because the medical examiner would go on vacation after the post-mortem examination and wouldn't do the autopsy until he returned. This was also near the end of the summer sessions, so many of the people that investigators needed to question were off campus, so that made it harder to track down people for interviews. Sergeant Rhodes said, quote, "When you have people to interview leaving town, that's just another box of crackers. You just can't interview people who aren't here," unquote. August 18th, 1973, just a few weeks into the investigation, attorney John Faze would announce to the public that they were looking for a specific man, around 6 foot tall, 185 pounds, with greasy black hair that was combed backwards. This lead would come from one of the tapes that Tess had recorded herself. This one would be found at her parents' home. And in this recording, she talked about not liking this man that often pawed at her, and that this was a man that made Tess feel very uncomfortable. There were also reports from the other residents living in the apartment complex stating that they were aware that someone had been entering their apartments when they weren't home, and they had all began to lock their doors shortly before Tess's murder. Unfortunately, it would be a year before they got any solid lead in Tess's case. It would be from a hair discovered at the scene. It would be discovered that this hair belonged to a man suffering from, don't come at me because I'm going to mess this up, it's a hard word, Monothrex, a disease that makes the scalp brittle and causes the hair to fall out in tufts and clumps. Tess's mother, Mildred, desperately wanted this case to be solved and truly believed that the investigators could get it done. But as the years went on with no resolution, all she found was disappointment and heartbreak. In 1975, a man named Lewis would call the Kansas City Star and speak to a reporter and tell them that he believed that a murder of another young woman was connected to Tess's. Helen Hansen, 25, also attended the same university as Tess, and in fact, 3 years of her attendance coincided with Tess's attendance. Both girls were music majors and also frequented the same bars close to campus, the Hole and the Palms. Lewis personally knew both Tess and Helen. May 21st, 1974, just 9 months after Tess's murder, police would receive a call that there was a woman's body found lying at 40th and Westport Road. When police arrived, they found Helen lying in the street with a faint pulse, and she had been stabbed multiple times. An ambulance would be called, but before it could arrive, Helen would pass. Helen had been at her sister's place on 40th and Oak, and around 12:25 a.m. decided she was going to leave and walk to a local inn that was about 8 blocks away from her sister's apartment. In that 20 to 25 minute window, Helen would be attacked. Investigators did look into this case due to the fact that both girls had the same major, they both attended the same bars, both had the same interests, and had both been brutally stabbed. However, investigators said that there was no connection, and they would move forward from this lead. To this day, Helen's case has never been solved, and her family has long awaited the answers, and they fear now it may never be solved. As the years went on, suddenly a decade would pass with no movement in Tess's case. But Tess's mother never gave up hope that her case would be solved. Tess's case would stay pretty stagnant until 1985, 15 years later, when Maryville would hire a new director of public safety, Keith Wood. Keith Wood would step into his new role with new eyes and ready to re-energize cold cases. While it seemed like this investigation had stalled in time, the community had not forgotten about Tess. Wood would tell the Maryville Forum, quote, "I think for the most part, some of us in law enforcement, whenever you're encountered with something like that, tend to take it rather personal because somebody was assaulted in the community you live in, besides the fact of just wanting to resolve it for her family and friends," unquote. Wood's plan was to look over all the evidence in Tess's case and start fresh from the very beginning. However, he would soon discover that there was no evidence in Tess's case, which was contradictory to all the archived newspapers that stated that there was. When Woods dug into this deeper, he found that evidence from the 70s and the 80s was stored in an old jail cell underneath City Hall next to what used to be the old fire station. And back in those days, the fire station would hang their fire hoses over the rail in front of City Hall to dry. And throughout time, water would leak down into the old jail cell where all this evidence was stored. And not just for Tess's case, many cases from the 70s and the 80s. Over time, the water would cause mold, and it would cause many things to deteriorate. By the time it was discovered, so much of the evidence had rotted away, and someone decided to just go down there and toss everything. So Wood's next step was to track down Tess's original case file, which he was assured would at least have a list of the original evidence items and photos from the crime scene. However, Wood would discover that Tess's original file was missing too. Woods knew coming into Tess's case there was going to be some challenges, and he knew that the evidence that they collected probably wasn't going to be everything they needed based on the fact that they didn't know what to collect back then like they do today. But for him to discover that all the evidence was destroyed and that they couldn't even find her original file meant that they had to go back to the newspaper archives, which we know can be filled with rumors. Wood's next step was to reach out to agencies who had helped initially in the beginning of the investigation, hoping to recover any files or evidence that they might have tucked away. He was able to find one small file in the Missouri State Highway Patrol office. It had very little to go off of, with incomplete reports and newspaper clippings from local news. Woods feels like from the very beginning, despite knowing that things were very different in 1973, that this case was investigated poorly. Woods knew the only thing he could do was start from the very beginning, which meant going back and talking to people who knew Tess and lived in the apartment complex and went to school with her in 1973. This meant going back to Edward and questioning him again, because not only was he the last person to see Tess alive, but he was also the person to find Tess. After speaking with him, Woods felt like he really ruled Edward out once again. His next step was to go back and speak to officers and detectives that worked on Tess's case. One of those investigators would tell Woods that they remember that they were pretty focused on this one particular guy, a suspect from Chillicothe, hopefully I said that right, but he couldn't recall his name or remember why they had come to this suspect in the first place. He also remembered that Edward was the last person to see her alive and the person to find her and that he had been ruled out, but that's all he could remember about the case. 4 years later, in 1993, Wood would decide to travel to Quantico, Virginia to turn over a presentation of evidence in Tess's case to the Behavior Analyst Department of the FBI. The same evidence would be presented again to the FBI analyst when the new public safety detective, Ryan Glidden, took over, and he received the same answers that Woods did in 1993. Nottoway County Sheriff Randy Strong, who worked Tess's case from 1991 to 2012, would say, quote, "Tess Hilt's case is simply a sexually motivated, disorganized murder. Those are easily solved if you look at it that way. Who kills women? Men kill women, generally. And your suspect is probably a young teenage to early 20s male, and he can't control his rage. He's probably drunk and can't control himself, and once he started doing something, it really got out of hand." Unquote. When Glidden became the new public safety detective in 2009, him and Strong would decide to pair up and work Tess's case together. From 2009 to 2020, the two actively interviewed hundreds of people and chased down every lead. By 2020, the case had once again came to a standstill. Strong and Glidden's plan would be just like Wood. They decided to circle back to the very beginning. That meant that once more, Edward would be interviewed and ruled out by Strong and Glidden. They said this time they brought what they called a truth verification device, and once again, Edward passed. They would go back and interview family, friends, and students. And again, they would circle back like they always do and find nothing new. Investigators were frustrated because Edward ticked all the boxes. No matter how many times they questioned Edward, he passed. They couldn't hold him as a suspect. In 2012, a friend of Teresa's would decide to open a Facebook page dedicated to her case. His hope was that he could generate tips because so many people were friends with Tess. And of course, I will be linking that page in the show notes and on my webpage. Mitchell Hall created, and it seems still runs this page to this day. You can find many pictures of Tess and articles about her case, and the Facebook page is often updated. There are two names that continue to come up in comments and tips on the Facebook page, all of which Mitchell says that he passes directly over to investigators. Any tips that he gets, especially about these two, go directly to investigators. One of these men that keeps coming up was a man who attended a party with Tess and 4 years after her murder would be convicted of stabbing his mother to death, but he was found not guilty due to reasons of insanity. He was institutionalized in 1979 and ended up taking his own life in 1985. I won't be sharing their names. They're on the Facebook page if you're interested. I bring these up because the people that knew Tess personally, that attended school with her, that were friends with her, continuously bring these two men up. The other man that gets mentioned again and again had direct contact with Tess. He was a professor on campus and also directed the play that she played Peppermint Patty in. The year that Tess was murdered, this man was going through a divorce, and Tess's friends said at the same time she was interested in a man much older than her, but friends said it was weird that she was either deeply in love with this man or afraid of him, but she never said who he was. This man was never interviewed after Tess's murder because he left town just 2 days after her murder and would move out of country to the Czech Republic. It would be reported in 2008 that he ended up taking his own life as well. Investigators were questioned about both of these suspects, but they stated that they were not publicly ready to talk about these two suspects. But they did state that there was questions about Tessa's relationship with an older man who they knew was a professor, who they said was a person of high interest in the case in the beginning and had moved to another country and had never been interviewed. Investigators again would reach out to other agencies that had worked Tessa's case from the beginning in hopes that any of them had found files or new evidence that they could work with. The FBI was able to provide photos of the napkin taken from the scene that had a bloody palm print on it. However, nobody knows where the original napkin is or when it went missing. In the 14 years that Glidden was on Tessa's case, he completed 70 supplemental reports, conducted hundreds of interviews, and him and Strong would travel to Missouri, Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, and as far as Kansas to interview people. In 2015, Glidden and other agencies would come to the decision that the next best step was to exhume Teresa's body. They would need to obtain permission from Mildred. Tessa's mother, not being able to control anything else in the investigation, had spent years delicately manicuring Tessa's grave as the only way she knew how to honor her daughter's memory. And investigators knew that they were going to disrupt that and that this was going to be a very hard choice. But Mildred gave them the permission they needed. Maryville Public Safety would secure a search warrant and proceed with the exhumation in the fall of 2015. The FBI would step in and be the lead on collecting and processing the evidence that they found. They found scrapings under Tessa's fingernails, and investigators didn't know whether they could use it or use it in the future, but they decided it would be collected and held. Unfortunately, in March of 2016, Mildred would pass away without ever getting the answers about her daughter's murder. Investigators do believe that it's possible that in the 50-year investigation that they have interviewed her killer. At this point, investigators believe that the way that this case gets solved is somebody coming forward saying they saw something or they know something. And they're asking that person to please come forward and contact them because they know that it's too late to solve this for Mildred, but they can still get it solved for her family. In Tessa's case, it seems that there were a lot of issues from the beginning. You had no assigned investigator, so you had a bunch of hands in the pot. The medical examiner went on vacation between the postmortem and the autopsy because for some reason they didn't have an alternative for that. And the fact that it took 2 months to solve a lead detective to her case, investigators say that caused problems and has delayed justice for Tess. Then to lose all the evidence, the crime scene photos, the original files, no matter how you look at it, this is a miscarriage of justice. There's no other way to put it. I will say it does seem like a lot of investigators have come onto this case throughout the years and have been truly dedicated to getting Tess her justice. They made it their mission to correct the wrongs and make this right for her family. Please share Tess's story in whatever format you're most comfortable with. I will have pictures up on my Sipping on Some Crime website for those who are interested, as well as important links and sources. I want to thank you for taking the time to get to know Teresa Hilt. And don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Because every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.